committee will come to order. I don't know who tapped the gavel before. It sounded like somebody else did it, but suddenly the room quieted down. No problem. I don't think we have a quorum yet, but we are actually not going to move the bill today. I don't see Representative Atkins. Oh, there he is. He's standing up there. So what we're going to do today, members and audience, is hear testimony on the Minnesota Insurance Marketplace bill. We have a number of testifiers lined up. We will have a full day for that, and since we're not taking action on the bill today, we're not going to officially move the bill yet. And so tomorrow we will be taking amendments and then voting on the bill. So we do have quite a few testifiers, and that's why I want to get started now. I know members that have a lot of places to be always all at the same time, so I think we'll have more members drifting in. So Representative Atkins, if you're ready, welcome to the committee, Representative Atkins, and if you'd like to start the conversation, even though we're not going to move your bill just yet. I hope that's okay with you. Of course, we'll move it tomorrow when we start taking the amendments. So if you'd like to present your bill, then we will go into our pretty long list of testifiers. So welcome to the committee.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. I appreciate the opportunity to present the bill. Quite honestly, like you, I'm here more interested, frankly, in what other people have to say than what I have to say. The testimony along the way has proven to be very helpful. It's something that a lot of folks are weighing in and giving great weight to as we move through the bill. I'm here to give you a couple of choices today. The two choices that we have, there will be a health insurance exchange in Minnesota. The main choice that we have is whether or not we want a federal government imposed one, or one that we grow here and do here and operate here in Minnesota. The difference between the two, if the feds do it, it will be operated in all likelihood out of Washington, D.C. You'll be able to go online, pick whatever health products you want, but if you have a complaint, you'll share it with somebody in Washington, D.C. The expense is arbitrarily set at 3.5% of the premium. Those sorts of things are beyond argument at this point. Whether we like it or not, that is the default if we don't do something by March 31st of this year, and that is the date that we have to do something. Failing to do that, we get the federal imposed option. That's what we've put together with the help of a number of members, some of whom are sitting at the table here with us this afternoon. Is something to start that discussion, and it would allow for a competitive online marketplace for people and businesses and small little entrepreneurs and so forth, families, to go online and in an apples-to-apples way shop competitively for their health insurance, for a product that meets their needs, that meets what they can afford, and that is of good quality. The way in which it would be operated is with from a governance standpoint, there's two ways that we could have set it up. One was as an internal state agency. The second was would be completely external, operated as a nonprofit. And quite frankly, we started out by looking at it as a nonprofit sort of agency or entity. The challenge that we found with respect to that was, number one, people who went online would not be able to avail themselves of public programs. So even though you might be qualified for a program operated by the state of Minnesota or by the state of Minnesota in conjunction with the state government or with the federal government, you wouldn't be able to enroll into a program like that. You'd be given a phone number to dial. And that sort of frustrated the purposes of getting people into the most appropriate plan for which they might qualify. So we sort of veered away from the nonprofit approach. The other challenge with the nonprofit approach is that they're not subject to any Minnesota laws. For example, with respect to rulemaking or operations, oversight issues, and so forth. So we veered back towards an entity that I would describe somewhat akin to the Minnesota Zoo Board or the PUC, for which you can have that interaction with the state, qualify for state-run public programs, but also manage to shop for your health insurance in a competitive fashion among those plans that are available to be online. The other piece that is important to note is this is the only way that one can take the opportunity to secure federal tax credits. As a result of those federal tax credits, taken in combination with the competitive nature of an apples-to-apples comparison like we don't have truly in Minnesota right now, the average family in Minnesota would be anticipated to save, according to an MIT health economist who ran all these numbers, about $490 a year. That's the average family savings. On the high end, some families with lower income are anticipated to save over $1,700 per year. On the low end, some families that that make in excess of $90,000 or $100,000 or $150,000, you know, you're up in those. You're not expected to necessarily save anything, but you would because of the tax credits not kicking in. But for businesses, so that's on the individual side. On the business side, typical business in Minnesota is anticipated to save 7.5% in their premiums. They're also expected to be able to have a little bit more competitive opportunity to purchase their health insurance. And finally, MCHA would no longer play a role anymore once this kicks in for savings to Minnesota's business community of in excess of $150 million. Those are some of the high points. In most of the committees, Madam Chair, that I've been into, I've tried to emphasize the elements of the bill that are particularly of interest to members of that committee. Since this is the Health Policy Committee, Madam Chair, I think just about the whole bill is of interest to this committee. So rather than try to go through piece by piece, I think what I'd prefer to do is give an opportunity for people to be heard relative to the bill. And then take whatever questions and concerns that members may have, and then look forward to coming back and doing amendments and taking up the bill informal tomorrow.
Right. Thank you, Representative Atkins. And just in relation to that jurisdictional piece, I guess what I would tell members is that I don't view the data practices portion as really being before this committee, and that sort of being handled in a separate way. And maybe, Representative Atkins, you could sort of inform the committee. That's on a bit of a separate track right now, which is part of the reason I don't think that we on this committee should start picking at that. And if you could just explain that, and members, of course, will have another, I assume, since this is not the last stop for the bill, there will be other opportunities, either for members who are on those committees or through those other members to discuss those issues again. But could you just explain where we're at
with that? Madam Chair, not the least of which will be the House floor if we make it that far through the committee process. So everybody will get another bite at the apple. With respect to the data practices, Representative Holberg, Representative Simon, and others on the data practices subcommittee have taken unofficial possession of those portions to try to work through. I think everybody is of one mind in terms of protecting the data and the privacy of individuals who would enroll through the and participate through the exchange, countering that with the sunshine laws that Minnesota is proud of and the open meeting requirements. So we've kind of vested with that subcommittee an opportunity to go through. They've taken additional testimony as recently as just this morning, and we're looking forward to getting recommendations from those folks. And my guess is it's going to be a bipartisan recommendation that recognizes the importance of those pieces. At which point, we'll take the recommendations in amendment form, marry it back up with the bill in some future committee, perhaps state government finance or elsewhere. And folks, again, we'll have another opportunity either in future committees, and there will be several, or on the House floor.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Atkins. Representative Mack has a question to that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a brief question maybe to your statement, understanding the issue of where the data practices part is at, but specifically what might be of interest to people on this committee and how it relates to health policy is if there are concerns about medical records and protecting doctor-patient relationships and what's how that information is handled. I guess I would see that as pertinent to the people that serve and have to make decisions over health policy, and so hope that questions relating to that and that specific data could be entertained in this committee.
Well, thank you, Representative Mack. I think I could let Representative Atkins address this, but my understanding from the Civil Law Committee and is that basically this there is nothing in this bill that actually impacts that data, but I'll let Representative Atkins address that.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Mack, because that has been a key concern. But essentially, the questions that get asked when you go on and you're going to purchase health insurance, because you can't be excluded anymore for a pre-existing condition or anything like that, it's, you still can be asked if you smoke. You can be asked how old you are. But we're not delving into that that data. We expressly don't want or need that data in order to make those decisions. Now, that being said, we want to make absolute certain, and that's why the Data Practices Subcommittee has been meeting. We want to make certain that there's nothing, you know, whether it's being bootstrapped in or otherwise, that would enable any sort of medical data to find its way to any place where it shouldn't go. And as most of us who've served here for more than 15 minutes know, between Representative Simon, Representative Holberg, and others, Mr. Gemberling, Mr. Neumeister, and a whole host of folks that are deeply concerned about privacy issues, I trust that they're going to do a good job of making sure that we don't have data wandering out the door, that private data that we don't want going where we don't want to go.
Representative Mack, anything further? Okay. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Atkins, I understand, if I heard you correctly, that the doctor can still ask us about smoking. Is that correct?
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair and Representative Franson, I believe that's one question that, you know, when you're going through and you're mm-hmm. checking the little boxes and you fill in your name and your address, I believe that's one that they can still ask.
Okay.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regarding the questions whether or not you own any guns, that happens to be in that questionnaire too when we go into our doctor's office. I'm wondering if that question is still going to be asked, and if that question is answered, will that answer be making its way up to the federal government hub?
Representative Franson, I think you're thinking of a different thing than what we're talking about. We're talking about the exchange website. There's no question about guns on that I'm aware. Representative Atkins?
Madam Chair, Representative Franson, not that I'm aware of either.
Representative Franson?
Madam Chair, I'm talking about when the doctor asks you questions in the doctor's office. If you own a gun, happens to be one of those questions?
Well, Representative Franson, we're not dealing with that in this bill whatsoever. So, I don't know what form you're talking about or anything, but there's nothing in this bill that talks about what happens in a doctor's office. This is about an insurance exchange. So I think that might be something that maybe you want to bring up at another time, but doesn't pertain to this bill. Representative Atkins, anything to add to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Franson, I think I know the form that you're talking about because I've been to the doctor in the past few years, and that was one of the questions that the nurse wanted me to, you know, that going in that questionnaire form. I just refused to answer it, and they still treated me anyway. But for purposes of qualifying for health insurance and purchasing your health insurance online, that is not a question that there's any intention to ask.
Representative Abler.
Thanks. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know when the time is to get this information, but before tomorrow night, I'd like to know about the data, health data question. We're going to do some risk adjustment. There's a high-risk pool, and plans will be giving and add-ons for people that have high-risk conditions. How does that get figured out, and how does that data get transferred back and forth? And it may be beyond your capacity, Mr. Atkins, but that's something I really do want to know, because that's, I think, part of the concern that swirls around us, and if mm-hmm. that's my question, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair and Representative Abler, that's a perfect question. It was one that was raised in the civil law committee, and it's one that is being addressed by this working group of the Data Practices Subcommittee. Representative Holberg and Representative Simon Winkler and Representative mm-hmm. Scott Lesh are working on those very issues. I'm a little hesitant to ask because what I'd be doing is trying to repeat what some data practices experts said. And for fear of saying it incorrectly, just I would ask you to trust that subcommittee has that goal in mind,
yeah.
And will be preparing an amendment to the bill that addresses that adequately.
Makes it, Madam Chair. I think that's one of the ones that some of us are concerned about. So I'm glad that's being worked on. I'll just follow that.
Yeah,
and take it offline.
Right, Representative Abler. I actually asked about that very thing with the folks from the exchange, and I think we might be able to have them come and answer that question because, and again, I'm with Representative Atkins. I hate to sort of give their answer for fear that I might misstate it, but I was satisfied that it's not really related to this bill, which is why I felt comfortable saying that we wouldn't be, that section of things wouldn't be discussed today, but certainly we can ask them about that, and if there is some concern, if if it turns out that it in fact relates to this bill, then yes, we could certainly discuss it. But if it doesn't, if it relates to other legislation that might be coming and isn't really on the table with this bill, then we might want to just set it aside for the time being. Not to minimize the concern about that issue, just to say it's important to see to focus on the bill that's before us.
Yeah, fair enough, Madam.
But we can certainly ask them when they come up to testify. Representative Atkins, anything you want to add to that?
No, Madam Chair. That's the Atkins understanding of what we're going to do with the data is not that we're sharing it with, in particular, the focal point has been the federal government. Is not that we're sharing, but we have the ability to ping, as I understand it, certain federal databases to verify what somebody has represented to us. Rather than sending it off to the feds, we do have the opportunity to check and verify whether the information that has been provided in the application is, in fact, a true representation.
Okay. I'm going to take a question from Representative Grunhagen, then we're going to move to the testifiers. Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Atkins, for being willing to get on the firing line, I guess. But the question I had, you made a couple of statements on the average savings of $490, and then also high-end savings of $1,700 and business savings of 7.5%. You're probably aware of the recent IRS projection of what premiums for a family of four will be, four or five will be on the exchange. They just put that information out, and they estimated that for the lowest end coverage for the bronze plan, it would be $20,000 per family per year. Even with the subsidy, depending on income, that's hardly even in the ballpark as far as you know, our current health insurance premiums are concerned. And we have predictions with in the state that we'll see individual policy premiums jump substantially, somewhere between 30% and 50%, sometimes even higher, based on the implementation of the exchange. So are you aware of those that information, and when you say savings, does that take those higher premiums into account?
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Grunhagen, for the question. I think we're talking apples and oranges, Representative Grunhagen. There's been some estimates that under the requirements of the Affordable Care Act, the entire Affordable Care Act, that some may see an increase in the cost of their health insurance. What we're talking specifically about here are plans that would be bought online in a competitive setting, plan versus plan versus plan. And these numbers come from MIT's health economist, Mr. Groman, that go through and talk about what the average savings per family would likely be. The exchange itself, the marketplace itself, is definitely something that is going to bring down the cost for people, but I wouldn't argue with you that a situation that covers more people and covers people with pre-existing conditions that the Affordable Care Act requires could perhaps be a higher cost to the average family.
Madam Chair, just to follow up.
Well, Representative Grunhagen, we're gonna have plenty of time to have this kind of level discussion. I'd like to get to the testifiers now, since we're
got a real short into comment.
The hearings, and we can at the end of the day we can. I don't think Representative Atkins is going anywhere, and you'll probably have more that you'll want to say at the end. So, if it's okay, members, I'm going to move to the testifiers now. Thank you, Representative Atkins. The first testifier up is Elaine Cunningham from the Children's Defense Fund. And we're going to, because we have quite a few testifiers, we're going to ask each person to take maybe 2 or 3 minutes to give their testimony. And so, welcome to the committee. And if you would introduce yourself for the record, and then go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Elaine Cunningham, and I am the Outreach Director for Children's Defense Fund, Minnesota. Children's Defense Fund is an organization that looks at policies and issues that affect the well-being of children, and we fight for those policies and issues to improve the lives of families. I wanted to take an opportunity to comment on two provisions within the exchange. One is the role of the navigator, and the second is the financing mechanism. Just for some background, as an organization, CDF has been involved in healthcare outreach since 1999, assisting families in enrolling in medical assistance in Minnesota Care. Currently, our healthcare outreach is done through a project called Bridge to Benefits, which is an online tool that families can use to find out if they are eligible not only for the healthcare programs, but for the SNAP program, WIC program, energy assistance. So it kind of looks at all public programs on that site. We work with nearly 300 community-based organizations to help screen families and let them know if they are potentially eligible for public programs. In 2012, we screened more than 52,000 families, which included 133,000 family members. I mention this to show that we have considerable experience in healthcare outreach, and we understand its importance in helping families understand and enroll in the programs for which they are eligible. With that, I have a couple of comments about Navigator, the Navigator program. We are concerned that it be a coordinated statewide effort that reaches all parts of the states. And by coordinated effort that reaches all parts of the states, I don't mean just by telephone or by an online presence. I think that there has to be an opportunity for face-to-face assistance with some populations. Not all populations need that kind of assistance, but for those that do, it's sorely needed. I also think that community-based organizations have to be a part, integral part of the exchange. They have the established relationships with families that will help families understand, which is the important key, what the programs and what health insurance is all about, understanding the public programs and the insurance subsidies. We also think that the compensation needs to fairly compensate organizations that act as navigators, and that needs to take into the fact that there is going to be high levels of usage and high, you know, levels of time and effort put into face-to-face encounters. So, and then we also are concerned about the conflict of interest statements and feel it needs to be a strong statement for all members of the Navigator program. And I will mention that we do not anticipate being navigators. We do not take public money as an organization, so our work is not funded through government funding. So we have no horse in the game, so to speak. These are just our observations based on our experience. The second thing I wanted to talk about is the financing mechanism. And I served on the Exchange Finances Work Group, and I'm not speaking on behalf of that group, but I wanted to comment on some of the discussions that came out of that group that we as an organization would support. We would ask that you consider that any funding mechanism for the exchange be fair and equitable and doesn't unfairly burden one entity. We thought that at least two sources of funding should be used to provide for the exchange, and that one be a base funding that is not affected by market fluctuations, and one that would take into account market activity. We would not support tapping into an existing funding source such as the Healthcare Access Fund to fund the exchange until we know what the state will do regarding a basic health plan and the continuation of the population coverage for populations not served under the exchange. So those are my comments, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Cunningham. Next up is Liz Doyle from Take Action Minnesota. And after Ms. Doyle will be Matt Toberin from the Minnesota AIDS Project, and then Annie Elmer. So if you could be ready to come up. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Doyle.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today on House File 5. My name is Liz Doyle. I'm the Associate Director of Take Action Minnesota. Take Action works, among other issues, on expanding access to affordable health coverage in Minnesota. Thank you as well to Representative Atkins for his leadership in authoring this legislation. House File 5 would put the state in a position to design a strong health insurance exchange that works for small businesses and individual Minnesota families. I'd like to first address the importance of a health exchange that can negotiate on behalf of consumers. Minnesota has a tradition of leading the country in initiatives to seek better care and lower cost from the healthcare system. We've taken significant strides, but much work is left to be done in this area. And our exchange is the next significant opportunity to continue this leadership tradition. The Affordable Care Act expressly offers state-based exchanges a wide variety of tools to negotiate better value for consumers. And many states around the country are currently fully utilizing these tools in the design of their health insurance exchanges. Members of this committee will well remember that half the states in the country chose to actually oppose the ACA when it was before the Supreme Court. Among the states that supported the ACA and are developing a state-based exchange, only one state, the state of Hawaii, has chosen to tie the hands of the exchange in its ability to negotiate better value. To date, every other state in that group has instead designed a smart purchaser exchange, and Minnesota consumers deserve the same. As the discussion unfolds about the exchange's ability to negotiate a better deal, it's important to consider the substantial financial investment that Minnesotans will make in products sold via the health insurance exchange. According to an actuarial analysis that was done for the exchange task force here in Minnesota, up to 600,000 Minnesotans will enroll in private plans in the exchange in 2016. The total premiums for those individuals will amount to $3 billion a year. Individuals and small businesses will pay a huge share of these premium costs, but the single biggest investor will be taxpayers. Most individuals enrolled in private plans in the exchange in 2016 will have access to advanced premium tax credits and cost-sharing subsidies. Both of these sources of financial assistance are funded by taxpayers. According to an actuarial analysis done here in Minnesota, the total amount of taxpayer investment in products sold via the Minnesota Exchange will exceed $1 billion a year. Minnesota taxpayers deserve to know that the exchange is using all of the tools at its disposal to use our tax dollars wisely. I'd also like to briefly address the conflict of interest standard. That is another key piece of ensuring that we're designing an exchange that meets the best interests of Minnesotans. Individuals and entities that would benefit financially from the sale of certain products on the exchange cannot be expected to have an unbiased view of which products are in the best interest of consumers. Favorable treatment of certain products over others would not be in the best interest of consumers and would create an uneven playing field among carriers. So we would support a very strong conflict of interest standard. Following the lead of other states, we would support an even stronger standard than the one in the current bill. Applying a conflict of interest standard to board terms after their completion, lengthening that conflict of interest time period longer than a single year. The purpose of the health insurance exchange is to bring better value to consumers in a costly and complicated healthcare market. Products offered through the exchange will be a substantial investment for individuals, small businesses, and taxpayers of Minnesota. We would encourage you to remain vigilant to the well-being of individual consumers, of Minnesota families, as you continue to design the health insurance exchange. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Dole. And just before you go, we've got a clarifying question from sure. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to clarify, and whether you can clarify this or maybe Representative Atkins, but you mentioned several times the word negotiate, that so the exchange can negotiate a better deal. You said we need an insurance exchange that can negotiate on behalf of consumers. I guess I'm confused. It's my understanding as I look at the bill, the exchange should not be and doesn't have the power to negotiate as the Department of Commerce and Department of Health signs off on the plans that would be eligible for the exchange, so I don't see the exchange having a role in negotiating any type of terms within these plans. So I'm looking for a point of clarification on that.
Ms. Doyle.
Representative and Madam Chair, it is clear under the federal health care law that the exchanges have to meet two prongs in order to for the products that are offered via the exchange. The first of those is meeting the bare bones federal minimum certification standards. The second of which is a determination of whether each of those products is in the best interest of consumers. And it's clear that there's a variety of tools that are offered to the state-based exchange in order to meet that second prong, including selective contracting, including various other purchasing strategies to get better value out of the healthcare market.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So they just, if I understand you correctly, they have to make sure that these plans meet these two criteria. But if I'm understanding correctly, they won't have the ability, the exchange that is, to negotiate prices or terms of a plan. That's the role of the Department of Commerce. And whether Department of Commerce can speak to that briefly, but clarification, particularly on that point, what exactly they're negotiating would be very helpful.
You want Representative Atkins maybe can come up and address that? Representative Atkins, I don't know if you heard the question. Do you need it repeated?
No. We might be talking about a couple different things, Madam Chair and Representative Mack, that just so we should go without saying, but we should say it out loud anyway, nothing changes what the Department of Commerce has the right to do. They continue to do the same sorts of oversight and approval process that they've always done. What Ms. Doyle referenced, though, is that under federal law, you're required to have another certification level that needs to be met for products to be sold within the marketplace. And that needs to be in the best interest of consumers. What we've had some discussion about is then, in addition to that, would the board have an opportunity to negotiate not over rates but over the sorts of coverages and products that are offered in the exchange in order to try to have those products compete against one another even before they're offered in the market, to put forward for consumers the very best products that are available. The argument that goes back and forth is some suggest that just setting that bar high enough ought to go far enough so that every product that goes in we know is a competitive, affordable, reasonable product that'll fit people's needs. So it's a little bit of a philosophical difference between the two camps.
Okay, Representative Mack.
I think just one more final, Madam Chair. So the exchange would not be able to negotiate directly with a plan, with Blue Cross Blue Shield, Health Partners. They negotiate amongst themselves. I guess I'm confused. Will there be a point where the exchange is negotiating directly with the provider, or once Department of Commerce says, yep, you've met the federal requirements, you've met our requirements, here's a plan that the exchange can or cannot accept, is there ever negotiating between the exchange and the health plan?
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, the short answer to that is yes. There is actually an opportunity for the marketplace, the board, to deal directly with each of the individual health plans that want to offer products. And this back and forth effort between the exchange and the individual plans, the aim being, and in terms of, I wish I could give you a little bit more accurate answer in terms of exactly what that will look like. The unfortunate answer is we haven't done it yet, so we don't know exactly precisely what that sort of back and forth will look like. But it's no different than haggling over the elements that if you're buying a car, there's more than just talking about the price. There's talking about the features of that car, and the board would like that opportunity in order to try to get the best car, regardless of what the price is, the most features in that product.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Atkins, and thank you, Ms. Doyle. And we do have another question, but before we get to that, I just want to tell members that I'd like to get through this list of testifiers, so if you can hold your questions to the end, it would be great. If you need something clarified, of course, go ahead and raise your hand. But we are going to also be, of course, hearing the bill tomorrow. We're going to have amendments tomorrow. We're going to take more testimony on those amendments tomorrow, so there will be an opportunity. And then if need be, we will reconvene after the State of the State and continue the discussion. So there will be time. You know, we all probably hope we don't have to do that, but if, you know, this is a serious bill, and we want to give people an opportunity to ask their questions and hopefully get answers to them. So just with that in mind, Representative Huntley has a question.
I have a question for Representative Atkins, Madam Chair. And Representative Atkins, it's my understanding that the exchange, if it gets into negotiating after somebody has met the certification level, they cannot negotiate prices. Is that correct?
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, that is correct.
Okay, thank you. Next on the list is Matt Tobrin, if I'm saying it correctly, and then we've got Annie Elmer and Arnie Anderson and Joe Peterson. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Matt Tobrin, Public Policy Director for the Minnesota AIDS Project. And we want to thank you for the opportunity to add our voice of support to House File 5 this afternoon. The mission of the Minnesota AIDS Project is to lead Minnesota's fight to end HIV through prevention, advocacy, awareness, and services. We support House File 5 because it supports our mission by providing easily accessible, affordable health insurance for people living with HIV and for those at risk of the disease. This bill will help reduce new infections, increase access to care, and reduce health disparities among the state. In Minnesota and nationally, we have a significant gap between the number of people who test positive for HIV and those who are maintained in care. Access to care, particularly ART drugs, is not only critical for the health of people with HIV, but it also carries important public health benefits, with recent research demonstrating that ART significantly reduces the risk of HIV transmission from an HIV-positive to negative individual. And this bill will go a long way into helping us close that gap and reducing the transmission of the disease. There are several issues that we look forward to working with you, the legislature, and the Exchange Board to further ensure that that the Exchange will cover a comprehensive set of benefits for people living with HIV. Many people in the state living with HIV are currently served by our IMCHA program because they are uninsurable by private insurance. And so as we go forward, it's very important that we have a smooth transition from people on the IMCHA program into the new Exchange system that will be built. An important step in this process is to foster a strong community-based patient navigator program. Navigators that are located in trusted, culturally competent organizations is crucial to linking people to care. Fair and adequate funding for the Navigator program is critical for making sure we ensure all Minnesotans throughout the state. So I want to thank you for your support for House File 5, and I'd like to introduce Annie Elmer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Annie Elmer. I live in Cottage Grove, and I've been living with HIV for 22 years. When I was infected in 1990, I was working at an insurance financial services company, so I had a health care coverage. In 2004, I decided to switch careers to start my own business. After COBRA ran out, I was unable to get health insurance because of my pre-existing condition. Luckily, Minnesota has MSHA, and I qualify for Program HH, which pays for premiums and HIV medications for people with HIV who don't have other options for coverage. If I didn't have health care coverage and I'd have to pay for my HIV prescriptions and medical expenses on my own, it would be a huge financial burden. I take four different HIV medications a day that cost over $2,000 a month. Without health insurance, I would never be able to afford these life-saving medications. If I had to pay for my medical expenses, I'd probably lose my home, which houses my business, move in with my parents, and figure out a new form of income. It's emotionally challenging for me to be in my 50s and need to rely on my parents to help pay my bills. And with them both being retired, this is worrisome for them too. I'm grateful for the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. I will no longer be denied health insurance coverage because of a pre-existing condition. By Minnesota accepting the Medicaid expansion, I will now qualify for MA. This program will provide me with more comprehensive and affordable coverage. In addition, Minnesota will save money because the federal government will be paying a much larger share of my medical expenses that the state is currently providing. The Affordable Care Act is especially important for people living with HIV. It will ensure that all low-income Americans, including adults with no children, will no longer have to wait for an AIDS diagnosis to become eligible for coverage. It makes sure insurance companies won't drop us when we're sick, and they won't be able to impose a lifetime dollar limit on essential health benefits. If I didn't have regular appointments to monitor my healthy cells and viral load or have access to medication, at some point my immune system would become so weak that I might get opportunistic infections. Waiting until that point of illness for health care would be much more expensive than keeping me and others with HIV healthy. By keeping people with HIV healthy and on medications, it will also help prevent HIV from spreading. People living with HIV who have access to medical care and are adherent to their medication can reduce their viral load to the point that the disease cannot be spread to others up to 96%. By providing adequate health care and ensuring people are adherent to the medication, we can significantly reduce transmission of the disease and prevent new infections. The Act also requires many insurance plans to offer HIV screening tests for at-risk people at no additional cost to them, making it more likely they will get tested and, if necessary, get access to life-saving treatment more quickly. It also requires many plans to provide coverage without cost sharing of HIV and other STI counseling for all sexually active women. I am very grateful for the care I've had from the state since my COBRA expired. Thank you for creating the Minnesota Insurance Marketplace so our state can offer the best health care options for everyone more efficiently and hopefully in the long run less expensively. And thank you for the opportunity for me to share my story with you.
Ms. Elmer, thank you very much for coming and sharing your story today. Arnie Anderson, and then Joe Peterson, then Mary Jo George, and then Rick Barco. Arnie Anderson. Okay, not seeing Arnie Anderson. Okay, Joe Peterson. All right, Mary Jo George, you're up.
Okay.
All right, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Mary Jo George, Associate State Director of Advocacy for AARP Minnesota. We appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House File 5 and would like to thank Representative Atkins for all of his work on this legislation. As many of you may know, AARP represents nearly 700,000 members statewide, 44% of whom are between the ages of 50 and 64. For many of our members in this age group, finding access to affordable health care has been challenging and difficult. Thus, we are very supportive of creating a health exchange that is consumer-friendly and provides access to quality, affordable coverage that consumers need. Overall, AARP believes that the exchange should ensure that all policies and operational choices should be considered through the lens of the consumer. Thus, we support language in the bill that includes strong consumer representation and a conflict-free governing board. AARP also believes that consumers will best be served by the creation of an exchange that is large enough to alter the insurance market and strong enough to foster active negotiation with the plans. This is the same approach large employers use to maximize benefits at affordable rates and the same approach used by the Veterans Administration to negotiate for prescription drug coverage. Today, unfortunately, Medicare does not have that same authority and as a result leaves $100 billion or pays $100 billion more for prescription drug coverage than Medicare. Last year, AARP conducted a public opinion poll that also showed broad support for this negotiation authority, and I do have copies of the public opinion poll here. While we support a robust exchange with competing plans, we also support the ability of the exchange to select and offer a manageable number of affordable quality health plans. We are concerned that if too many plans are allowed to participate in the exchange, it could be difficult for consumers to easily compare plans. Both our experience with the original rollout of Medicare Part D and subsequent research has shown this to be the case. Too many choices actually can impair and not help decision-making around insurance. Lastly, with regard to education and outreach, AARP wants consumers to have clear objective information about their health plan choices from a variety of sources. Therefore, we support the role of both navigators and brokers. We would want to ensure, though, that any financing arrangements with brokers do not create incentives to steer consumers to products that may not be in their best interest. Additionally, we believe navigators will play a critical role in ensuring that we reach out to groups that may be harder to serve due to language and cultural barriers, as well as a lack of familiarity with insurance altogether. In conclusion, a strong outreach program with a conflict-free governing board combined with the authority to negotiate on behalf of consumers will ensure that the exchange works in the best interest of Minnesotans. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. George, before you go, if we could have the page distribute those. And then Representative Mack had a clarifying question as well. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I heard, and I also have a copy of the printed testimony, so I think I heard and have this correct, in terms of your concerns regarding too many plans available to consumers. And I guess I'm just trying to clarify and understand, is it your hope or AARP's position that they'd like the exchange to more or less control the market in this situation of what consumers do and do not have access to?
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, we actually think it would best serve consumers if the exchange would manage the number of products in the plan to ensure that consumers have access to optimal plan choices. We really believe, and I think the research supports that, and I could get you some data on that, that what happens is when consumers are given so many choices, they oftentimes do not have the ability to really make good choices. And we've seen that with Medicare, both with the Advantage and the Medicare Part D plans, that seniors oftentimes are leaving money on the table and are not making good choices about changing plans that are more suitable to their specific condition. So I wouldn't want to say we want to limit it. We want to create a robust exchange that really allows for market competition and choice.
Madam Chair, and I appreciate your latitude with questions, and I guess just one thing, I know we have a lot of people to get through, and I guess I'm just hoping, I think there will be some follow-up and clarifying to some of the assertions made by testifiers, and I'm wondering if testifiers will be back tomorrow, if we're not going to be taking questions in between to ask follow-up questions on points. I think that would be helpful for members of the committee to know. But in a follow-up to that statement, I guess, sure. You know, the word manage, how do we define manage? And the other follow-up and clarifying question would be, isn't the exchange, aren't we going to be paying a lot of money for these navigators, for these in-person assisters, in order for them to help people navigate what might be a bit of a comprehensive and complicated system? I guess I think the more options, the better it is for consumers. I think people are intelligent. And so I guess my question is, isn't that why we have navigators, so that they can help people where it does get confusing, where it does get difficult?
Madam Chair, Representative Matt, absolutely. I absolutely think you're right. There's both a combination approach of a robust education and outreach program through navigators and brokers, but also, again, I'm going to draw on our experience from Medicare, creating some standardization and some simplification for consumers is ideal. One of the things that I think is really important for members to understand is that the ACA itself does allow for sort of four tiers of products already. So, for example, there's the metal tiers, the bronze, silver, platinum, and gold. So we think that's great, but we also think there will be a number of products offered within each of those tiers to give consumers broad choice. But I really think, again, Medicare, CMS found when they initially introduced some of these Medicare plans, they had over 140 plans. Seniors were signing up for plans 1 year, and the next year they weren't there. And so that created a real problem with continuity of care. And what CMS decided to do was to create some of that standardization and to create products, for example, that didn't avoid risk. So your cost-sharing requirements were set up so that, you know, you wouldn't avoid people with diabetes, for example. So there's a number of techniques and tools that the exchange can do to kind of create sort of that consumer standardization and some of the information they need. But I think it's a combination approach of both the exchange having the authority with the outreach and education. So I hope that was clear.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Ocean. I think we're getting into more of the discussion on the substance of the bill, and I know there's going to be a lot of interest in that. I don't want to cut that off, Representative Mack, but let's get through this. I'm going to ask the testifiers, if you can, please stay till the end. Hopefully we'll be able to have some of these questions. Members, please make note of your question and who you want to address it to. And again, we'll hope that everybody will come back tomorrow as well so that we can get your input as the various amendments are discussed as well. So thank you,
absolutely.
Ms.
Thank you,
George. Rick Varco and then Catherine Commit.
Chair Liebling, members of the committee, my name is Rick Varco. I'm the political director for SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. We represent about 15,000 healthcare workers around the state in hospitals, nursing homes, and clinics. As we move forward with this exchange, I think it's important to remember those for whom this bill is too late. One of those people was the son of an SEIU member. He was diagnosed with cancer. He had a very difficult chemotherapy that forced him to quit his job. Of course, without a job, he soon lost his health insurance. Without insurance, cancer took not just his home and his savings, it took his peace of mind and his dignity in the last years of his life. Towards the end, he was told that if he wanted chemo, he should bring cash to the hospital. With an exchange, he would have been able to buy insurance without being screened for a pre-existing condition. Without income, he would have been subsidized and thus able to afford health care. That's essentially why we are here today doing this bill. I want to emphasize the importance of the Exchange Board's ability to selectively contract with health plans in order to prevent cost increases and get better coverage. No matter how many different plans are offered within the exchange, if the Exchange Board cannot selectively contract with plans, the option of lower cost, better quality plans will be off the table for all individual consumers. By selectively contracting with insurers, the Exchange Board creates new, different options for consumers, potentially lower cost, better quality options that would otherwise be available. This is just like the negotiations that go on with any employer who has insurance approved by the Department of Commerce. Those folks find a way to selectively contract and negotiate about plans. We think the Exchange Board should be able to do something similar. When Minnesota implemented competitive bidding process for Medicaid managed care contracts in 2011, it resulted in a savings of $175 million for Minnesota taxpayers in fiscal years 2012-13. The Any Willing Health Plan system diverts public money to insurance companies while real competition delivers better care at lower prices. I understand that the plans are concerned that, you know, of being prevented from offering a plan within the exchange, and I think that's a fair concern for them to have. But the Massachusetts Connector, which is an active purchaser, so far has not rejected anybody from participation in that state exchange. And it's not in the interest of the board to keep providers out. They're going to want to work towards a deal that keeps everybody in. And then second, since when does the free market guarantee every buyer gets a seller? Free markets presume that every agent will seek out the best deal for itself and the consumers it represents. If the legislature prevents the Exchange Board from acting or selectively contracting, you're not preserving a free market. You're rigging the market to protect the interests of health insurance companies. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barco. Okay, Catherine Commit, and then we have Kate Johansson, then Chris Schneeman, and then Twyla Bray. So you could, if you could all be ready to come up. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I do have two handouts for the committee.
Okay, we'll ask the page to
describe. Members of the committee, my name is Catherine Commit. I'm from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and I know this is not the tax committee, but I want all of the members of the committee to be aware of what the impact is of the ACA and the taxes, both the federal taxes as well as the gross premiums tax, which is the funding source that is cited in this bill, what the impacts will be to the premiums, because we hear a lot about people saying it's going to save money, it's going to cost less, and I think that that's an overgeneralization. So I will start with my remarks, and I'm happy to answer any questions about the document or documents. Again, I'm Catherine Commit, representing the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and my members include Blue Cross and Blue Shield, Health Partners, Medica, Metropolitan Health Plan, Preferred One, Sanford Health Plan, and UCARE. My colleagues and I have been working very closely with Representative Atkins, and we appreciate all of the hard work that he has done on this important legislation. The Council of Health Plans has always supported universal coverage. We want everyone to be covered. In addition, we support the creation of a state-based health insurance exchange that works for Minnesota, but we have several key concerns with the current language of this bill. First, a major concern is that the language gives the board the authority to decide which health insurance plans can be offered through the exchange. Put simply, this is the government picking winners and losers in the private marketplace, and we oppose this language. The federal law requires a whole host of new processes and quality metrics that a plan must meet to be considered a qualified health plan. The criteria for participating in an exchange should be objective and based on the criteria set by the federal law and the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Furthermore, if the goal is to maximize choice and competition, which consumers and employers want, then the exchange should be an open marketplace. This bill, the language in this bill, limits consumer choice. Our question to you is, if a health plan is able to meet these high standards, then why wouldn't it be allowed to participate in the exchange? We don't understand how this board will negotiate with health plans, and you've heard some of the earlier testimony refer to that. Representative Atkins has already testified that the exchange cannot negotiate the cost of products. That's something that is determined when the health plans file their rates and their products with the Department of Commerce. That's where the rates and the products get approved. So it's very unclear to us as to how the exchange is going to negotiate or perform some sort of a negotiating role. A competitive marketplace must entice both sellers and buyers to participate. This bill discourages interested qualified insurers from wanting to participate. This bill limits the competitive marketplace and may not provide the best health insurance options to consumers buying insurance through the exchange. Second, we are concerned about the high cost of operating the exchange and how the exchange will be funded. The federal law requires that the health insurance sold in the exchange must cover a benefits package that is more comprehensive and more expensive than the benefit package many people have today. The federal law also requires health insurance to reduce cost sharing for the insured by having lower deductibles and lower copayments. The days of someone having lower health insurance premiums because they bought a high deductible, high copay plan are disappearing. The federal law will no longer allow that. As a result, these new federal requirements will increase the cost of coverage, making products more expensive than they are today. Currently, many people who have health insurance through the small group market have policies with deductibles ranging from $5,000 to $10,000. After 2014, the federal law restricts these deductibles to much lower levels, making insurance products more expensive. The state hired two consultants, Jonathan Gruber, a health economist, and Bella Gorman, a health actuary, to analyze the impact of the health care reform law on the Minnesota market. In their 2012 report, Gruber and Gorman estimated that the impact of the requirements of the federal law may increase premiums in the individual market in a range from 26 to 46%. And that is on the yellow document that I distributed. Gruber and Gorman estimated premium increases in the small group market to vary even more, from a range of negative 22% to a positive 28.5%. Keep in mind that these are premium impacts estimated before either the federal or state premium taxes and assessments are added. This is just as a result of the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Although federal law will provide tax subsidies to help lower-income individuals purchase coverage, we know that many of these people do not purchase coverage today. So for these people in the exchange, having to pay for health insurance coverage will be a huge new monthly expense. In addition to the premium impact as a result of federal reform, is the added cost of financing the operations of the exchange. This bill requires a 3.5% premium withhold or premium tax, which will be added to the cost of health insurance sold through the exchange. We strongly oppose this tax because it falls disproportionately on the fully insured market. And I'll just pause here and say, as many of you have seen before, I've distributed the pie chart. I don't have it with me today, but the pie chart that shows that the Minnesota legislature can only have an impact on the fully insured market, which represents about 25% of the state's population. This would be even a subset of that because it's only on the fully insured market that purchases coverage through the exchange. So it's a very, very narrow base that would be bearing this, this 3.5% tax. In other words, the majority of our population who receives health insurance through a self-insured plan, like the state employee group and health insurance plan, or from any of our large employers, will not pay for the cost of the exchange. We view the exchange as a public good for the benefit of the entire state. Therefore, it should be funded using a broad-based mechanism that is fair, equitable, and accountable to the legislature. When you add the new federal taxes and the new state premium tax to the increased cost of health insurance products sold through the exchange, we are very concerned that these products will still be too expensive for individuals and small employer groups. If health insurance sold through the exchange is unaffordable, even with the federal tax subsidies, then we could actually end up with more uninsured Minnesotans, not fewer. The exchange staff has testified that the budget to build the exchange is $165 million. This is an expense of $165 million before $1 is spent on providing health care to those purchasing health insurance through the exchange. The exchange staff has also testified that the annual cost to operate the exchange will be $62 million. This is a significant cost that will be borne by those purchasing health insurance through the exchange. Again, that little subset of the fully insured market. As the legislature determines a broad-based, fair, and accountable funding source for the exchange, we would urge a thorough review of the exchange budget. Third, we have concerns with the bill relating to the composition of the Board of Directors and the conflict of interest language. Federal regulations expressly state that the Exchange Board must ensure that a majority of the board members have relevant experience in the areas of health benefits administration, health care finance, health plan purchasing, health care delivery system administration, public health, etc. However, as written, House File 5 does not require board members to have relevant experience as required by federal law. Members of the Governor's Health Insurance Exchange Advisory Task Force are also concerned that this language excludes individuals with current relevant experience from serving on the board. Minnesota's nonprofit health plans have a great deal of experience providing health insurance coverage to Minnesotans, and we think we do a really good job of it. As nonprofits, each health plan has a mission to most effectively cover the health needs of the populations they serve. Individually and collectively, the health plans have served the state exceptionally well. The implementation of the exchange is large in scale, affecting many parts of the health insurance industry. It will have a significant impact on the existing marketplace and regulatory structure relating to health care insurance. As such, it would be beneficial to consumers to have members of the board who know and understand how the health insurance system works. Without relevant experience, the board will be limited in its ability to make fully informed decisions. And finally, Madam Chair, I want to mention one more important issue, and that is making sure that the exchange is ready for open enrollment on October 1st, 2013. As I said at the outset, the health plans want the exchange to work. However, getting the IT systems up and running is an enormous and expensive undertaking, both for the state as they create the new systems and for the health plans to be ready to connect with these new systems. IT readiness is perhaps the biggest problem for the exchange and is yet the least talked about. If the exchange can't be supported by this new IT system, it will not be operational. This is a real possibility. The key to making the exchange operational on time is to do what is minimally necessary to become operational. Features that are nice to have but not vital to the operations of the exchange can be considered later. The more complex we make the IT infrastructure now, the less likely we will all be ready on time for the October 1st launch. As policymakers, you have an opportunity to thoroughly review this legislation to ensure consumers have an exchange that meets the minimum requirements at the lowest cost. We urge you to avoid making the exchange overly prescriptive, with limited consumer choice, and so expensive that we end up with more people uninsured than we have today. We want the exchange to work in Minnesota, but as currently drafted, we cannot support the bill. For the reasons I have just mentioned, we have serious concerns that the exchange will be able to succeed. Nevertheless, we remain committed to working with Representative Atkins on these major concerns and other provisions that have been modified so that we can create an exchange that works for all of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. And members, we have three people on the list, and I really, we could probably spend the rest of our time in a good discussion with Ms. Commit, and you know, unless there's something that absolutely has to be clarified, not discussed, but clarified before we go on, I'm just going to go on to the next testifier because I really don't want to cut off some of the folks that have come to talk with us today, and we do have quite a few left. So Kate Johansson is up.
Madam Chair, just to clarify, Madam Chair, can we, if Ms. Commit is available or back tomorrow, we can bring her back up and ask her questions at that time?
Absolutely, Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I just want to give everybody a chance here. Otherwise, we're cutting off a lot of folks who've taken their time to come today.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Kate Johansson. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and its 2,400 employers, 80% of which are small businesses eligible to participate in a Minnesota State Health Insurance Exchange. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House File 5, and thanks also very much to Representative Atkins for carrying this complicated and incredibly important legislation. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce has long supported the legislative creation of a health insurance exchange in Minnesota that empowers consumers to shop based on their needs and resources in a competitive market. We do have concerns about the bill in its current form, but appreciate that those involved have expressed that this is a starting and not an ending point, and look forward to working with them to achieve the objectives just stated. The chair has noted that this is a committee of broad jurisdiction, so I will try to balance my comments so that they are both concise and as comprehensive as possible. The chamber's concerns fall into four main areas. The first is that, recently noted by Ms. Kmit, of governance. Two issues here concern the chamber primarily. The first is that of the board composition. The current language in the bill, we're afraid, does not create a board that would call on the experience and expertise necessary to create the best possible board to run Minnesota's insurance exchange successfully. We are also concerned that the current language does not reflect the federal requirement that a majority of those on the board have the technical expertise from the industries impacted, again, to contribute that necessary knowledge to create the best possible board. Alternatively, we think that this board should reflect, as other Minnesota boards do, cross-sector collaboration, including all of those areas affected, both industry and consumers. Second, we have concerns about the conflict of interest language. In short, the stringency here is detrimental to the quality of the board. We think that this language currently deprives participation from those with the experience necessary to form the best possible board, and that is why the task force recommended that a small number of board members actually be allowed to have a conflict of interest and recuse when appropriate. The chamber feels that experience is constructive, not corruptive in these instances, and that recusal is a small price to pay to access that experience in a meaningful way. The second area in which we have concerns about the bill is with respect to adverse selection. The language in the bill currently allows the board to exclude certain plans. And certainly, there are a lot of names associated with this power. Some call it active purchasing, others call it active selection. The problem is not the name, it's the policy and the effect, which is to let the board pick winners and losers. And why is that bad? Well, it's bad for a couple of reasons in the chamber's estimation. First, it limits choice, and consumers want choice. Talking with small businesses, you see that they desire to have the most number of choices possible so that they can tailor their product selection to what works best for them and their employees. Second, it could disincent plan participation. It takes a lot of resources to develop these plans, and even though we already have high criteria set, being able to arbitrarily exclude those plans from participating creates a real disincentive to developing them. Third, it could dampen innovative purchasing mechanisms. Many of the small employers with whom I speak regularly are interested in a concept called defined contribution, where they could provide their employees with a monetary contribution and let them shop. If there are too few choices, people might not have the same incentive or impetus to let their employees go out on that purchasing mechanism. The chamber's alternative would be a clearinghouse, which I wanted to clarify. I think the 6 of 13 states that have declared their model have declared a clearinghouse model, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. And this clearinghouse model is one in which any plan that meets both federal and state criteria already developed to protect consumers, would be allowed to offer their products to consumers. We understand that many people are concerned about the issue of simplification. They think that perhaps consumers will be overwhelmed by a number of products. And certainly we're not insensitive to this concern, but we do point out that the state has invested $41 million in a website to help people navigate this choice, and certainly both brokers and navigators would be excellent resources in helping anybody who desires additional assistance. I would also note that this is not an issue that needs to be addressed. The federal regulations do not require this type of purchasing mechanism. As you will probably note from today's testimony, it is very controversial, and it's very complex, and so addressing it in a short time might not be in the best interest, again, of creating the most effective insurance exchange for the state. The third area in which the chamber's concerns fall are those of accountability. For all intents and purposes, this bill creates a de facto state agency, but without reciprocal state oversight. For example, the bill exempts the board from rulemaking. A more appropriate alternative in the chamber's mind might be to create emergency rulemaking and then subject the board's activities to standard rulemaking processes thereafter. Second, the board transitions to basically governing itself after a certain date. We feel, again, that the legislature and the executive branch should retain some of their traditional authority in regulating or at least having oversight of a board that has significant fiscal and regulatory power. And another and final issue with respect to accountability is that this bill does create a dedicated fund but does not subject it to legislative appropriation as other dedicated funds are subjected to. The final area that I would like to note dovetails off of that last point, and it is one that is particularly important to the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, especially in our capacity in representing small business owners, and that's the finance mechanism. This bill finances an exchange, which Ms. Kmet, I believe, just outlined the expense of, with a 3.5% withhold. Some people would characterize this as a gross premium tax. Again, small business owners don't care what you call it. They care what it does. And in this instance, this finance mechanism will increase the cost of premiums for small businesses. And that's unfortunate because small businesses are fully insured consumers. They already pay more for health care than other consumers. They're the market most vulnerable to losing access to insurance due to affordability. So anything that increases their premiums is a threat to them right now. I believe Ms. Cunningham noted that she served on the finance work group of the advisory task force, and I also served on that group. And that group recommended, and the task force adopted recommendations, that the finance mechanism be broad-based and not punish one group. And I don't believe that this mechanism achieves those goals. So in conclusion, I do want to thank you very much for allowing me to testify today. You have a huge job to do and very little time to do it in. Minnesota Chamber of Commerce wants our exchange to work, but we think that the best avenue to doing that is to focus on functionality and get the basics right before tackling unnecessary controversial issues. And I'm happy to be a resource in any capacity that I can in achieving those objectives.
Thank you, Ms. Johansson. Chris Schneeman, and then Twyla Braze, then Ronald Seeloff, then Jonathan Watson. People could be ready to go. And we do have quite a few testifiers left. Let's see, we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 people left in about 15 minutes. So, right? 15 minutes. So I'm going to ask you to be really brief and, try to cover the – try not to repeat if you can. If you've been listening and you can avoid repeating something that's been said, please do. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, certainly, Madam Chair, committee members, Representative Atkins. Good afternoon. My name is Chris Schneeman. I own an independent insurance agency here in St. Paul. I employ 10 employees, and we assist over 200 small employers and several thousand individual policyholders manage their health insurance options. I'm here today representing the Agents Coalition for Healthcare Reform, which is comprised of the four professional agents associations operating in Minnesota, which includes the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters, the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, the Professional Insurance Agents, the Minnesota Independent Insurance Agents, and brokers. Collectively, we represent over 54,000 Minnesota licensed professional agents and their employees. As such, we work closely with both group and individual market consumers on a daily basis here in Minnesota, and our livelihoods are based solely on how well we deliver value to our clients. Agents have supported and continue to encourage an insurance exchange that supports the unique Minnesota healthcare system and its competitive insurance market. Our members have spent countless hours participating in Governor Dayton's Health Insurance Exchange Task Force and the various working groups that are part of that. And at first, I'd like to start off by thanking Representative Atkins for working with us to eliminate a portion of the bill that addressed agent compensation and agent regulation, and working with us to find workable language on other issues that impact how agents and brokers and the exchange interact in their various roles serving the folks of Minnesota. We do have remaining concerns with the bill and continue to work with Representative Atkins to address them and appreciate his willingness. First, we are very concerned about the lack of oversight of the bill, the amount of control over the insurance market placed in the hands of an unelected body. While there is a minimal amount of audit oversight, the fiscal note reflects that there is no additional effort is planned by the legislative auditor, and that there is no mechanism for the legislature to approve the budget of the exchange. We're very concerned that while many or most task force members support a public-private partnership for the exchange, this bill sets the exchange up as a public agency, leaving no real private sector elements. It has been stated that this is due to the need to have a state agency complete Medicaid eligibility determinations, but we see that there are ample evidence in other states that it is possible for an exchange to be modeled after our own MCHA and to delegate the Medicaid eligibility duty to DHS and the counties. Indeed, we believe that the Affordable Care Act specifically allows for this. Third, we're concerned that the exchange may include types of products beyond those that are required in the Affordable Care Act, specifically that of adult dental products, which we think are included by definition right now. We would like to see a prohibition of products other than the health and pediatric dental that are required in the bill, so that it is clear to the legislature in the future that it's not intended for the exchange to interject itself in other areas of the private insurance marketplace. We're concerned that the funding mechanism that imposes a new 3.5% tax on premiums on policies sold within the exchange will add to the affordability problem of policies sold both inside and outside of the exchange, since the Affordable Care Act requires that the premiums be the same for similar policies both sold inside and outside. This will add to costs of premiums that are already going to be increasing due to the changes required elsewhere in the Affordable Care Act. This added expense will be felt solely by the fully insured market, which is now less than 25% of our health insurance market in Minnesota. We think that the fees should be placed on a much broader base that does not fall exclusively on individuals and small employers. Finally, our most serious remaining concern is the active purchaser model. As representatives of both individual and group consumers, we do not believe the market will welcome the exchange board with a four-person majority to be able to decide which products are best for everyone in Minnesota. This language contradicts the spirit and the intent of what a true marketplace is, and it reduces it to a rather limited offering of products that someone else is choosing for you. If this were logical...
Steeman, I have to ask you to finish up, please.
Thank you. If this model were logical, then we would all be asked to wear the same outfits or required to buy the same groceries. In Minnesota, as elsewhere, we thrive on having ample choices. President Obama believes in choice and competition. We'd really like to encourage the Minnesota Exchange to adopt those principles. Thank you very much, Chairman.
Thank you very much. Sorry to shorten your testimony here, and I apologize to everybody, but we really we might be able to go a little bit over. We think we're going to do that if members can stay, but we do want to hear from everybody who's come to testify today. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Braze, and then after you, we've got Ronald Seeloff, Jonathan Watson, Kelly Wolf, Audrey Britton, Danny Watson, David Hoden. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. I'd like to make just 2 points. The first point is that the exchange is not a marketplace. It's a government agency, which is under federal control. This government exchange will be an arm of the federal government extending its power and authority into the state of Minnesota for the purpose of controlling health care and limiting choices. In various committees, Representative Atkins has mentioned having to follow the federal law or pass federal muster. Note that in lines 2.6 to 2.9, they define this marketplace as the government exchange in the federal health care reform law. The law requires the exchange to follow federal law and federal regulations, to report annually to the federal government, and it requires the exchange to include at least 2 federal health plans operated by the U.S. Office of Personnel Management. Even the definition of navigators is tied to the federal law. If insurance agents are ousted by the federal government, they will no longer be included in the Minnesota Exchange. Furthermore, in the handout which I provided for you, and I apologize because I should have made this the first page, but I just wanted to show that in the very center of it, according to the state contract which with Maximus, who is building the exchange, you'll see here that in the contract they call it the Federal MinHIX, Federal Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange. And so it's actually federal, and this exchange is Minnesota in name only. To explain one of our concerns about exchange operations, let me just tell you about the demonstration videos on the Maximus website. If you go to the Maximus website, there are 9 demonstration videos. And they have a character, John, who is going to enroll his family, which is Jane and, I don't know, a girl called, we'll just call her Jenny. And so he provides all the information to enroll them in insurance, and then it says, you know, you'll need to wait for a little bit because we have to go to the federal hub and other sources to validate who you are. So this is how the exchange works. But when the information comes back, it shows that Jane is pregnant, and he gets to choose whether or not Jane is pregnant. So this is a little piece that people probably don't understand about the operations of the exchange. And furthermore, when you get further into the demonstrations, what you'll see is that John gets an email from the exchange telling him that we'll just call him Johnny, little Johnny has been born, and now he should register Johnny with the exchange. And I think that people don't understand that this is how the exchange operates. It's not like a marketplace where you go without, you know, with whatever information you have. There's other information about you that the exchange grabs. So this exchange is not just a marketplace, it's an IT superstructure. As some people have said, this is an IT system that's being created here, and it will connect with various state and federal databases with the federal government through a federal server called the Federal Data Services Hub for the purpose of deciding whether or not people can get insurance and tracking to see if they haven't, as we saw with little Johnny. So as reported in the U.S. Today, the hub is the largest consolidation of personal data in the history of the Republic. Well, in short, no person will be able to purchase health insurance until no person having to go to the exchange, if you're forced to go to the exchange, none of those folks will be able to purchase health insurance until the federal government looks through various state and federal databases and gives the okay. Meanwhile, the individuals sitting at home on their computers have no idea what's being shared or revealed, or that they are asking the federal government for permission to purchase health insurance. Our second point is that the board will have authority over the insurance and health care options available. They can limit both health plans and interfere in medical care. The exchange will be voluntary only to some people. Many people will be forced into it to purchase government-subsidized insurance, including the middle class, especially as premiums under Obamacare are now expected to rise up to 190% higher than today. That was a new report out as of yesterday.
And Ms. Braze, I have to ask you to, if you can wrap it up, please.
I have only a short piece left. But the board controlling these options are a group of 7 very powerful strangers who do not have to listen to Minnesotans or even be from Minnesota. Exempt from rulemaking, they will essentially be a law unto themselves. And furthermore, the consumer members may be voiceless because of the four vote majority underlines 5.18. In addition, look at the creation section on 2.21. This is the section that Senator Lori has called population health, which is short for the government interfering in treatment decisions and the patient-doctor relationship under the guise of quality and care coordination. Thus, the exchange will be about much more than a place to buy health insurance. We expect it will try to exert its control over the doctors and medical care, perhaps rationing care to cut costs. Finally, in conclusion, we oppose the exchange because we see it as a takeover of healthcare by the federal government, and the board will follow federal law and have control over healthcare options and medical decisions, and we do not believe, no matter what protections there are, that this data-sharing superstructure with the federal government should be created. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Brazen. Just before we go on, let me just ask if there's anybody on the list to testify who cannot be back tomorrow, just in case. Okay. So, and you, Mr. Seelop. So we're going to take you next, and then we're going to go to the folks that can't come back tomorrow, and then we can have the room until 4 o'clock, but we absolutely are going to be done then. Representative Atkins has his own committee to chair after that, and so we are going to stop at that point. So if folks can, you know, hold both their questions until tomorrow, and then if those who can come back tomorrow, we will allow you to do your testimony as we begin tomorrow. So, and I know, Mr. Seelop, I received your testimony, and I read it, and I don't know if other members received it as well. They may have.
I did email it to the members. I have copies. With the permission of the chair, if the clerk could distribute them to the committee.
Mr. Seeloff, that would be great. And because if you read through all of that testimony, we'll be here for much longer than we have.
I do not intend to do so.
Yes, and it is, thank you. And it is very interesting and it's very complicated. And so I think giving it in written form is a very good idea. So if you could just take maybe a minute to sort of introduce yourself, the committee, sort of orient us to what we're hearing, and that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Adkins, members of the committee, my name is Ron Seeloff, and I'm a practicing attorney from Eagan. The area of my practice is the intersection of tax law and family law. And I wanted to address two issues. The first is the effect of the exchange law implementing the ACA on children of single parents and divorced persons. Now, 30% of all the kids of the state live in a single-parent family home, and at some time during their minority, half of the kids live in a single-parent family home. So this involves a very large and significant class of people. The second issue I want to deal with is the very substantial deterrence that the ACA will have on people's willingness to work and bad decisions made by people concerning income. My major recommendation to you is that although I do support the legislature adopting an exchange bill of some kind, I think that the legislature should memorialize our congressional delegation and the President of the United States to delay the implementation of Obamacare for 1 year. And the reason I say that is because although this body and the board and the task force have been doing everything within their power to make the exchange happen, the people of Minnesota are not ready for it. They don't understand what's going on. With respect to the family law issues, is that we have two statutes, one of which prohibits a change in a child support order based on a law change. That should be changed. Secondly, we have a statute 518A.41, which allocates the responsibility to purchase insurance for children essentially based on availability of insurance. Now, having distributed to you a copy of an article about the Obama administration just announced that when there is a health insurance plan on a group basis available, the way I read that is that exchange-based insurance will not be eligible for the tax credit. That's a very significant change. It just came out a couple of days ago. I'm just going to conclude with three things. An example I gave to you was a family of four that increased their income from $80,000 to $93,000. Let's say that they got a raise. The effect of that increase of salary will mean that almost 100% tax on that incremental income. Why work? The second thing I wanted to say to you is that, and this is important to understand for divorced children, the ACA allocates the mandate to purchase the insurance, the penalty for failure to do so, and the tax credit for the insurance for minor children based on who is awarded the dependency exemption in the divorce decree or otherwise. The problem is we have thousands and thousands of child support orders and decrees where the allocation of this responsibility is going to go in such a way that these families are going to be losing thousands of dollars of subsidies that are available under the ACA because our statute can't supersede the ACA.
Yeah. So, yeah, Mr. Seeloff, I'm so sorry. Okay. This is really, I really appreciate your cooperation, and this is, members, I really encourage you to read his written materials, which go really into depth and explain what he's talking about here, and I think you've given us a good flavor of it, Mr. Seeloff, but we really have to go on to the next testifier.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm so pleased that you read my material.
I did indeed. Okay, Ms. Britton, welcome to the committee. And if the other folks, we've got Danny Watson, David Hoden, the other folks who said they could not come back, if you'd please come up and be ready to give us your testimony. We really do want to hear from you. And please welcome the committee.
So, Representative Liebling, Chair Liebling, and members of the committee, thank you very much for hearing our testimony today. I appreciate allowing our, I believe at the end of the session, we have brought forth 10 business owners to testify before the various committees hearing House File 5 and Senate File 1. I feel it's very important that these business owners be heard because we have entities that are speaking on behalf of small businesses, and I've yet to see any small business owners testify against these provisions. So my long version of the testimony is going around. It is footnoted. This is the short version of my testimony.
Thank you.
My name is Audrey Britton. I'm the public chair, public affairs chair of Small Business Minnesota. Small Business Minnesota is a statewide, nonprofit, nonpartisan association. All of our members are small business owners here in Minnesota. Our mission is to use fact-based information to voice the true needs of small businesses in Minnesota. Small business is vital to Minnesota's economy. We are Minnesota's largest job creator. And even though Minnesota has more Fortune 500 companies per capita than any other state, it is rarely noted that Minnesota small businesses employ more people than all the state's Fortune 500s combined. 98% of Minnesota businesses are small businesses. 86% of businesses employ 20 people or fewer. The vast majority of small business owners take home an annual salary of less than $100,000. This means that very few small business owners can afford lobbyists, and most cannot spend their time at the Capitol today. Every person who's coming up to testify after me, and including myself, we're trying to run our own businesses and yet make sure that this House File 5 gets the support that it deserves and that the real voices of small businesses are heard. Because the majority of small businesses employ less than 20 people, access to group rates is extremely limited and therefore cost prohibitive. Small Business Minnesota strongly supports the provision in House File 5 that allows the state to negotiate group rates or be an active purchaser. This is about leveling the playing field. Negotiating with insurers for lower prices and better quality coverage is commonplace with large employers and public employees. Small businesses need the same access to better prices and benefits. Affordable health care is vital to attracting and retaining talent. Small business owners have told us that they have trouble attracting and retaining top talent because they cannot compete with the health care packages offered by big businesses. An owner of a small engineering company told me that he lost an employee because she was planning to start a family and needed to go to work where there was better maternity coverage. Other small business owners describe the stress of hiring, knowing that they'll have to tell candidates that they do not offer coverage. And there's other stories in that longer testimony that you can look at. Small Business Minnesota strongly supports the provision in the bills that calls for a representative of small business on the Health Care Exchange Oversight Board. We agree with the inherent conflict of interest statements that are in these bills, House File 1, Senate, or House File 5, Senate File 1. We want to do what we can to ensure that this position is filled by someone who truly represents small businesses without an affiliation to organizations that have a history of lobbying for or with insurance providers and large corporations. Small businesses have plenty of experience with insurance markets overseen by insurance companies. We need a strong board member who can negotiate on our behalf and serve as a true representative of the voice of small business. I will forego my summary, but in conclusion, I will say that a vote against these provisions is a vote against small businesses. Thank you for your time, and I'm going to let other business owners come up and share this written story.
Okay, while you're getting settled, we had Representative Zerwas who said he had a quick clarifying question, and then Representative Mack, if you've got something you must ask.
Oh, you're direct, Representative Mack.
My brief question was just for the previous testifier. Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to clarify, earlier we talked about and clarified from the department and pretty succinctly that the exchange will not have the ability to negotiate rates or prices of any kind under this current language. You referenced several times how this will help small businesses by allowing the exchange to negotiate rates on your behalf. And I guess it was pretty simply put earlier that that's not the case, and I'm looking for clarification from your point of view on that.
So we're looking for whatever the active purchaser agreement is. I'm not here to be an expert on the bill. I'm here to tell you what small businesses need. I would hope as the legislators you will craft a bill that will support this, what we need, which is access to group rates. So however that works, fine. I'm not an expert on health care laws or bills or legislation, but do really need to stress that small businesses are the largest employers in Minnesota, and yet I feel we're the least heard of all the voices out here.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Britton. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is David Hoden. I'm sure you'll find my story a little bit different than what you've heard so far.
Okay,
I'm here to speak in support of House File 5, and specifically about two sections. I believe it's imperative that the state be involved as an active purchaser to help ensure that individuals as well as small businesses have access to affordable options for health care. In addition, I strongly support the conflict of interest language in the bill. I'll quickly try to share my personal story to highlight why I believe this. In 2002, I followed my dream to start my own small business as a licensed contractor. As my wife was employed part-time and had limited options for affordable coverage for our healthy family of three, the best plan at that time was over $1,200 a month with high deductibles. I spent several months exploring our options for health coverage. I quickly found out that being small and self-employed meant little buying power, high payments, and high deductibles. I eventually found a company that offered us a policy. We went through the application process, were accepted, and I launched my business in March 2003. In early 2004, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer. I got two opinions, as recommended by the insurance company. With pre-approval from them, I had surgery at Mayo Clinic in July of 2004. After several months of waiting for the bill to be paid, I received a letter from the insurance company denying my claim due to what they stated was a pre-existing condition, and that is not true. I spent several months, untold hours, emails, and phone calls, eventually hired an attorney to fight them. And remember, as a small contractor, I didn't have a group policy. I had no one to help me fight them, okay? The insurance company had millions of dollars, plenty of attorneys on staff, and I'm sure they knew I could only fight so long. I drained our savings, dipped into my IRA, and finally gave up. The insurance company then canceled our policy. We were without insurance, and I was uninsurable because now I did have a pre-existing condition. No insurance company would give us a family policy, and we were told we had made too much money the previous year to qualify for Minnesota Care. In 2005, my wife was offered a full-time contract with affordable health insurance, excluding me, and eventually she was able to add me to the plan through an open enrollment period. I did spend over a year without health insurance coverage. I ended up paying $8,000 to an attorney, lost 3 months of work just fighting the insurance company, and paid the Mayo Clinic $30,000 over the next 5 years in monthly payments. Kudos to Mayo Clinic, they didn't charge me any interest. I want this bill to include the state as an active purchaser. I believe it will foster competition and also provide a better chance for individuals and small businesses like mine to obtain affordable health insurance. And I'd like to see that the conflict of interest language preserved that prohibits anyone with ties to the insurance industry from being on the governing board. Thank you to the committee for taking the time to listen to
me. Thank you, Mr. Hoden. And we have two more people who can't come back tomorrow? Because I know Representative Atkins has to leave, and he has to actually be in another place in 5 minutes. So if you can be really quick,
I'll be as quick as possible. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dani Watson. I own a small business in Wayzata. And like two-thirds of businesses in Minnesota, I'm a one-person shop. I'm a health marketing consultant, and my employees, if you will, are other freelancers. I support the active purchaser provision in House File 5. This provision is very important for growing jobs in Minnesota by giving entrepreneurs and small businesses access to true group rate pricing. Personally, I have not been able to afford to pay both a living wage and offer health insurance through my small company during periods when I have had employees. And I couldn't have stayed in business for 19 years had I not had coverage through my husband's employer. One former employee of mine told me last week that had she not been covered under her husband's policy through a large business, she wouldn't have been able to work for me when she did, and she did great work. So in my circle of colleagues, the cost of health insurance is a key factor in deciding whether to start or grow a business. I care about this because the science shows that starting and growing small businesses is a building block for better health outcomes in communities. As you may know, the Minnesota Department of Health lists small business development as a core indicator of future health outcomes in Minnesota, along with indicators such as prenatal care and on-time high school completion. The draft Healthy Minnesota 2020 Action Plan has as one of its priorities to strengthen communities to create their own healthy futures. It specifically states that Minnesota's attention to small business development will drive improved health outcomes by reducing health disparities, creating more employment success for more people, and encouraging stable, more cohesive communities. The active purchaser provision will make health insurance more affordable for businesses like mine. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We've got Craig Britton. And then we have Todd Mickelson. I don't know if, is Todd Mickelson here? And are you able to come back tomorrow?
I could.
That would be great. We would appreciate it.
Stay up late.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'll make this quickly. My name is Craig Britton. I am the partner, senior partner of SwitchTrack, which is a two-person consulting firm. We work with small and mid-sized businesses to help them grow. We're strategy experts. I was also the chief marketing officer for two Fortune 500 insurance companies, so I know a lot about insurance companies. I'm here to strongly urge that whatever you call it, but group rates be made available to small businesses. This is what makes this worthwhile. Health insurance cost is my largest expense. Because I have a minor pre-existing condition, I have to buy insurance through MCHA. My cost annually for just myself is $13,000. When I include my wife, it's over $20,000. That's an unbelievable burden for a small business person. Small businesses are being crushed by the cost of health insurance. Without being able to offer health insurance, we cannot attract employees. Employees stay at large companies because they get it. Insurance companies cannot hold costs down. They would prefer to underwrite individuals. They hate pooling risk, but that's why they were created. Without pooling risk, insurance companies can literally price individuals out of the market and do all the time. You've heard many stories today. Businesses with less than 100 employees are 99% of the businesses in Minnesota, and they employ over 40% of its workforce, and all of them struggle with this cost. So I encourage you to support the active purchaser, and I encourage you to put the consumer, the small business person, on the oversight board. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony, members. We will be back tomorrow, and we'll hear more testimony, and we are
adjourned. Madam Chair.